From Oregon to Georgia, West Virginia to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, labor unions are getting an assist from far-left activists in their organizing efforts, and they're using some shady tactics. Keith Williams from the Center for Independent Employees joins us with details. Congress is on its August recess, but with a looming budget deadline and a full plate of critical issues, they should return to Washington. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. During and since the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of students have gone missing from school. Eric Boehm and Emma Camp report. And if the presidential candidates want to know what policies will revive the U.S. economy, they should look to the states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Labor unions are now making an unholy alliance with far-left activist groups as they seek to expand the number of companies they represent, and they're using subversive tactics to do so. For details, we turn to Keith Williams. Keith is Senior Vice President at the Center for Independent Employees. Keith, welcome to American Radio Journal. Keith, when we talk about the practice of salting, it's a term that I suspect most Americans are not familiar with, especially if you talk about it relative to labor unions and labor organizing. So tell us a bit about this practice of salting.
Sure, Loman. Salting is basically the practice of inserting union organizers, often paid. They're collecting a paycheck from the union, and they go into a business and interview as if they're employees. So the assumption is you as a business owner are interviewing this person for a job. The reality is they are a paid union organizer who is coming in to infiltrate and has the goal of organizing, unionizing your workplace. And they may or may not announce their intent, but that is a kind of a long-term strategy that unions have used for years. But there's renewed interest in it. I know we're going to talk about here. But that's essentially what's going on. So you've got paid union organizers infiltrating companies as if they're employees or interested in being hired, really for the purposes of organizing those businesses.
So you have this salting practice taking place, but what is disturbing here? You recently had an op-ed in Newsweek, and you were talking about the fact that the Teamsters Union, and we're specifically referring to the recent labor negotiations with UPS, the United Parcel Service, that the labor unions and the salts of the labor unions are working with the Democratic Socialists of America with the goal of expanding their control over the supply chain. Tell us a bit about this strategy. What are they trying to accomplish here?
This is an interesting setup, an interesting partnership, in large part because most of the rank and file aren't necessarily on board with the agenda of the Democratic Socialist of America, right? So happened upon this webinar where the Democratic Socialists and the Teamsters were partnering for the purposes of training up union salts, members of the Democratic Socialists, for the purposes of advancing the Teamsters in workplaces. Now, what I found really, I was going to say concerning is probably understatement, but disturbing, was the assertion that we need to do organizing because we need leverage over the, I'll say, not just the national, but the global supply chain. And one of the analogies that was used was, if you remember, the Evergreen container ship in the Suez Canal. And when that container ship blocked the Suez Canal, it was costing globally $9 billion per day, $400 million an hour. And that analogy was brought up with the comment, imagine what we could do if we can disrupt the supply chain like that. So this is no longer about wages, hours, and working conditions. This is, you know, the DSA sees big labor as an opportunity to leverage their political agenda. And they are interested in, I'll say, not just the political side, but really they view unions as a way to ultimately achieve their ends of making us into a socialist nation.
As you look at this attempt at salting union organizers into these companies, is this a case of where the unions might actually be working against their own best interests? Because if you get a company here, Keith, and the company ends up with a lengthy strike, perhaps goes bankrupt, goes out of business, then employees all lose their job and nobody really wins. So how is this in the best interest of the Teamsters Union to be doing this, or are some of them unwitting dupes in the process?
Well, I think it goes back to the rank and file, what they know and what they don't, right? I mean, most union members are, the analogy's been used, were conservatives at home, Republicans at home, Democrats in the union. So their values aren't necessarily reflected by the political agenda of the union. I think that's true regardless of the union, whether you're talking the Teamsters, whether you're talking anybody in your first responder type unions, or teachers even for that matter. I know there's a lot of frustration among teachers about the politicization of their profession and how unions have politicized them. People, I think, in general are just tired of having their profession or their job politicized by big labor. And I think they definitely, it's a calculated risk on their part. Salting as a practice of organizing can backfire as well. Imagine as an employee who is, you're being fed this adversarial relationship mentality only to discover that this person who is agitating is actually a paid organizer collecting two paychecks and really is only there to get you fired up and unionized. That can certainly backfire as well from an organizing standpoint. So it's a calculated risk, but I think they're, given the direction things have gone with organized labor, it's a risk they're willing to take.
You mentioned in your Newsweek piece, and you used this specific quote from the Democratic Socialists of America website, where they say, quote, "We want to collectively own the key economic drivers that dominate our lives, such as energy production and transportation," end quote. To what end? To what end does the DSA want to be able to own key economic drivers? What's their end goal here?
The key sectors that they referenced in the webinar, and actually I should mention there were multiple webinars occurring. We know of one in North Carolina as well. So this is not just a one-off. They are clearly coordinating. But the key sectors they're looking at are logistics, healthcare, and education. And those are, in their words, they are reproductive areas of the economy. So they can get leverage there. So obviously in education, if you can seize the means of production in education, right, you can reproduce that mentality, that ideology. Same is true in healthcare, and then obviously logistics. Teamsters ultimately have their goal of bringing Amazon into the mix, and that's the real pie in the sky.
We have been talking with Keith Williams. He is Senior Vice President at the Center for Independent Employees. Keith, tell us a little bit about the center. Also, a website where folks can go to read your Newsweek op-ed and learn additional information.
Center for Independent Employees is a 501c3 nonprofit. We focus on advocating for employees who are opposed to unionization in the workplace. So we are basically a mechanism to help employees who wish to decertify an existing union, or if they're being abused or misrepresented, provide them with legal resources and options to remove that union in their workplace. You can visit our website at centerforindependentemployees.org.
Keith Williams of the Center for Independent Employees. Keith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He normally keeps an eye on Congress, but they aren't there. They're on a rather extended summer break, vacation, whatever you want to call it. But Scott thinks they ought to get back to work. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
A lot of things going on, Scott. Why is Congress still out of session?
Well, typically Congress takes a state work period. They also call it the August recess. Obviously, to the American people, it looks like a big vacation. There's a lot of congressional delegations that travel all throughout the world, and folks are getting stuff done in the district. But I think that the optics right now of Congress being outside of Washington when they have so much on their plate to do is a bad optic. And the reality is, it seems like Biden's out to lunch. He's been on vacation repeatedly throughout the month. Everybody remembers the long vacations that Barack Obama would take, You know, Donald Trump would go to Bedminster. You used to have George W. Bush going to Crawford, Texas. Presidents like to take time off during the summer, and so does Congress. That's fine if you've completed your work. It's the same thing for the American people. If you don't have anything on the desk, you deserve a little bit of time off occasionally. But the reality is Congress hasn't done its work. They've only passed one appropriations bill in the House of Representatives. We know that we're headed to a looming fiscal fight in September, and there's only, I think, 11 session days to get any of that work done. We need to make sure that the American people have a plan in place for our fiscal trajectory, not just the unlimited debt that we're taking through the debt limit agreement from earlier this year. Many members said, well, we can fight on appropriations. Let me tell you what that fight looks like. This week, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, called up Chuck Schumer, and they began negotiations on a short-term CR. Tell me if you've heard this before, Lohman, but what that's going to do is it is going to take spending into December at current levels, and then they're going to have the big omnibus appropriations battle once again. We always know that the holiday season is this feeling from members of Congress and the House and Senate. They just want to get out of town. They want to spend time with their family. So the leadership concocts this plan to put all the pressure right up against the deadlines, and that way they can get their big bipartisan legislation through at the last minute. Well, many people in Congress have said, you fooled us way too many times on this. We're not going to go for it. I think you're seeing House conservatives develop a concerted effort to push back against a short-term continuing resolution that puts us into the early days of December and builds that political pressure for an omnibus or two separate minibuses on domestic spending and national security spending. It's not acceptable. If Congress comes back into session on Monday, they can adjudicate legislation related to the Maui fires. I know that in September, you're going to have a vote on a disaster supplemental. The administration is preparing their request. It's expected to include about $12 billion for the disaster relief fund and $24 billion for Ukraine spending. Many people in Washington say, why would we put that together? Why not have two separate votes? Why not deal with the disaster in Hawaii right now and save the conversation for Ukraine for another day? But the thing is they probably can't pass the Ukraine bill without the votes for the disaster supplemental on things like Hawaii that ultimately go into the disaster relief fund. So it's going to be a big, big fight here, I think, in September. I think Congress needs to come back from recess, back into session on Monday, and get back to work.
Yeah, certainly the folks in Maui need help now, not sometime in September or October. So while Congress is on this August recess, Scott, we do have the political world continues to turn, and we have coming up in just a few days the Republican presidential debate. Your thoughts on whether or not that's going to be really a pivotal event here?
Well, the big question is, will he or won't he? And the he, in this instance, is Donald Trump. Is he going to show up for the debate, and is he going to take on the Republican rivalry from Ron DeSantis and Tim Scott and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence and Chris Christie and others that have qualified for the debate, Vivek Ramaswamy? And is he going to allow them to take shots at him, or is he just going to say, I don't need to participate, I'm already the consensus frontrunner for the Republican nomination? He also hasn't signed the so-called loyalty pledge through the Republican National Committee, and that would technically make him ineligible. So we'll see what happens over the next several days. I think that as the debate moves forward, there's going to be a lot of attention on Ron DeSantis and Tim Scott, a couple of the people that are polling decently in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. And if Trump doesn't show up, obviously he likes to be the focus of attention. He likes to be sort of the entertainer. Everybody is going to tune in. It's going to help ratings, right, if Trump participates. If he doesn't, can any of these other candidates for president of the United States break through with a moment that separates them from the rest of the field. And if Trump isn't there, does everybody gang up on DeSantis since he's in second place? Or do they start to look at ways to pick people off and try to eliminate their own presidential campaigns? Obviously, if you're not qualifying for the debates and the threshold that is set by having 40,000 individual donors or at least reaching a certain percent threshold in the early states, maybe it is time to hang it up already, even though we're in August of 2023. I know that Mayor Suarez down in South Florida and Miami has already suggested that he might step away from the presidential campaign if things don't turn around quickly for him. But we've got a lot of time left. We know that next week when the first debate happens is really like the kickoff, I think, of the 2024 presidential campaign. It's going to be fun and exciting. I think most political junkies are going to tune in.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. They're united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. If anybody wants to check out Club for Growth, the website is clubforgrowth.org. You can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Millions of students disappeared from virtual classrooms during the COVID-19 pandemic, and many of them have not returned to school. Eric Baim and Emma Camp of Reason Magazine have details.
During the first few months of the COVID-19 pandemic, an absolutely staggering number of students apparently just went missing from American public schools, and many of them still haven't returned. This has serious implications, obviously, for those kids, but it also says something about the way the pandemic just disrupted the way really everybody in American schools learns, and that has obvious serious implications for the future as well. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is my colleague at Reason, one of our assistant editors, Emma Camp, who has written an excellent piece in the latest edition of the magazine. The headline on that piece, millions of students went missing from classrooms during the pandemic. Many haven't returned. I think this is her first time here on the show. So Emma, thanks for joining us and welcome to American Radio Journal.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here, Emma. Let's just dive into the numbers here. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of students that just sort of disappeared from public schools, according to this report.
Yeah, so the AP and Stanford did some research, and looking at 21 states, they estimated that about 230,000 students went missing from classrooms after most schools had returned to in-person learning, so after the original brunt of the pandemic. And so by missing, this means students who stopped attending public schools but didn't enroll in private schools, they didn't move, and they didn't register for homeschooling. So this indicates that these students are most likely just dropped out of the education system entirely. And the fact that this analysis was just over 21 states and Washington, D.C., it indicates that the actual numbers of students who, during this period, just aren't attending school at all is much higher. And it's actually not just older students who dropped out of high school. You would think it would mostly be older students who dropped out of high school, but there are also a decent number of younger students in elementary school as well, who seem to not be getting any kind of formal education.
I mean, it probably goes without saying, but we should say it anyway. Like, this isn't great for those kids.
Yes, this is obviously an extremely negative outcome. If you don't get a basic level of education, your future earning potential goes down dramatically. A lot of times this is most likely students who are in an unstable family environment and either their parents aren't able to take them to school or they're taking care of younger siblings or they're older students who are working. And either way, this is an outcome that we very much don't want to have. And we have really strong reason to believe that this wouldn't have happened if we didn't have massive school closures. The same AP and Stanford study looked at years before the pandemic, and they found basically no students who went missing in this way.
Yeah, obviously a majorly disruptive event for education. And I think you've done some great reporting on this over the past year or so, Emma. But I mean, it not just for this large number of students that went missing, but even for the kids that are still in school, right? I mean, we've seen test scores drop, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. School closures were just a complete disaster for students' educational attainment. And we have reason to think that it needn't have been this way, right? Countries like, I believe, Sweden, it might actually be Norway, who basically didn't have any school closures for younger students. Their test scores stayed the same, and there's no reason to think that kids got sicker than they would have.
We're chatting with Emma Kemp. She's an assistant editor at Reason Magazine, chatting about her latest piece in the magazine about the kids that just went missing from classrooms during the pandemic. Many of them have not come back. But Emma, while we've got you here, I also need to ask you about a piece that you wrote for our website, reason.com, because this was something that caught my eye online a few weeks ago. There was this poll out that many people were interpreting as saying that, like, high school boys are suddenly way more conservative and high school girls have gotten way more liberal. You dug into this poll, though, and I think it's useful maybe to have a little bit of a debunking here. So in the little bit of time we have left, is that true? Are high school boys suddenly all conservative and high school girls are liberal? Did we, like, create some sort of weird gender effect here?
Yeah, so not really. So a couple weeks ago, there was a survey that went around, and it portended to show that high school boys, or rather 12th grade boys, were twice as likely to identify as conservative than high school girls. And that is technically true, but it hides some important context. So there was a lot of failure to read the y-axis. So the clear majority of both sexes in this survey identified as neither liberal nor conservative. And in fact, it was just 23% of high school boys who identified as conservative in this survey. So, you know, 3 in 4 of these 12th grade boys don't identify as conservative, right? Most of them don't have a strong partisan political identity either. Same with girls, only about 30% of them identified as liberal. So the reality of the situation is not that high schoolers are being radicalized towards one political orientation or the other. It's rather that the clear majority of both genders don't really care about politics that much or find their political identities outside of right-left binary. And instead, the minority who are politically engaged are just more likely to be liberal if they're girls or conservative if they're boys, which is a far less bleak and scary picture than a lot of people were painting.
Yeah, I think that's probably true of most things in politics in general, right? Like, we overestimate a lot of these left-right dichotomies. We overestimate the sort of extremes. Most people don't spend all day thinking about politics. Unfortunately, those of us who get paid to do it do have to spend all day thinking about politics. Emma, thank you for walking us through these two fascinating and I guess somehow connected stories. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
And again, that is Emma Kemp. She's one of our assistant editors at Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine, and really one of our rising stars. You could check out her work, not just at Reason, but also she's had a couple of op-eds in the New York Times as well, including one about the self-censorship that she found on her own college campus. Check that out there and find her work, of course, at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
State tax and spend policies can be a guide to policies the federal government should adopt to revive the U.S. economy. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Well, the 50 states, the laboratories of democracy, have shown that real policy solutions to real policy problems are free market solutions that seek to limit or reduce the role of the big government in the lives of hardworking American taxpayers. August 23rd begins the first of the presidential debates of the 2024 cycle, and the next president, Republican or Democrat, should look to the states for a vision of what a prosperous America could look like. In short, how does America emulate the success of the states that are our economic powerhouses, like Texas and Florida, while avoiding the same big government mistakes that states are making, like big government states like New York and California, that are hemorrhaging Americans and businesses? For the economy, competitive pro-growth policy should be the goal. The best way to position the economy for growth is to reform and simplify the tax code and cut rates, and of course avoid the elimination and expiration of the Trump tax cuts, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that goes away if Congress does nothing by the end of 2025 for individuals. A simpler and more transparent, neutral, and predictable tax code, principles that are in line with the ALEC principles of taxation, will allow Americans to keep more of their hard-earned dollars. But taxes are just one side of the fiscal coin. Getting spending in check is crucial for economic growth. Engaging in more of a priority-based budgeting system like states have can help Congress choose which government programs are essential and which can and should be cut in many cases. In addition, adding spending restraints that require a balanced budget and limit the federal government's budget growth can help ensure that spending is kept in control for the future as well. After all, 49 of the 50 states have some sort of a balanced budget requirement in their state law or their state constitution, with Indiana being the most recent state to add what could be the most taxpayer-friendly balanced budget requirement in America just several years ago. In education, the status quo has been used as a one-size-fits-all model for decades that assigns students to a public school based on nothing more than a zip code in many cases. The result is that many students get trapped in public school that is simply not the best for them. Today, a number of states have greatly expanded the options available to families when it comes to their students' education. This includes breaking down regulatory barriers to homeschooling, permitting micro-schooling, authorizing more charter schools, and modifying state law that education dollars can follow students, not systems, in the form of Universal Education Scholarship Accounts, ESAs, now that nearly 10 states in the last several years have adopted. The states have been beacons of what free market, limited government policy solutions look like. Just in the last several years, a total of 21 states have cut personal income taxes, with several making cuts several times, not to mention the 9 states that have no personal income tax whatsoever. In 2022, we saw the revitalization of Steve Forbes' flat tax revolution, with 5 states making the switch to a flat personal income tax from a progressive income tax. Already in 2023, we've seen 10 states pass personal income tax reductions, and they are proving to be a bipartisan move as Democrat governors and legislatures are passing tax cuts as well. The only way for this to continue, however, is for the federal government to stop its war on federalism. An agenda from the current Biden administration that worked to federalize elections, prevent states from cutting taxes if they took the federal bailout money, and disallowing right-to-work laws hampers Americans' prosperity. What is needed to enhance real federalism is far more than rhetoric. A national discussion on the need to devolve significant federal functions back to the state and local level, as our founders intended, will be essential for the next administration. Post-COVID-19 America is ready for free market, limited government policy solutions. After the federal fiscal policy fiasco of the last several years, with out-of-control government spending, a debt now at $32.5 trillion, runaway inflation, and the increase in burdensome regulations, the next president, Republican or Democrat, owes Americans an agenda in pursuit of more individual freedom and prosperity for all. As our Alex Rich States, Poor States report annually documents, the best way to do that is look to the states where the 50 laboratories of democracy continue to deliver bold, free market, pro-taxpayer stories to emulate. For more information on state-based ideas that will help bring real policy solutions at the federal level, visit ALEC.org and richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHYP-LP in Cory, Pennsylvania, KION AM and FM in Salinas, California, along with WGAO-FM in Franklin, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.